That's actually why I wear sunglasses now, from the light of AI being so bright.
Casting.
Guys, I published 4 fucking packages this week over a weekend.
Using Claude Code?
I started on Cursor. I got addicted. I blew through $100 worth of credits and then immediately switched to Claude Code to save money.
My God. So when you say you switched from Cursor, so Cursor is like the, I don't know what you, like, I call it, I guess, OG. A wrapper. But it's the thing that allows you to use different models. So I actually get pretty much unlimited credits. So I've been using all the different models. I've used a couple of different softwares. I have found that Cursor or Copilot, in my case, directly in VS Code is the best because I still get to use my VS Code extensions. I have found that my ability to produce stuff has skyrocketed. I don't know if my like actual useful output has changed all that much. Now, you said you've delivered 4 packages, which is pretty cool.
It's like you're in the Matrix, because the thing I realized you could do is you could open multiple Claude Code windows, first of all, within one project. So you can be working within one project and you'd be kicking off multiple queries working simultaneously. And Claude knows that the other Claude is working. So you can run like AI agents almost. No, they're pretty good at coordinating.
It's really weird.
They sometimes wrap up a little bit, but it's pretty good. The other piece is, you can spin up multiple windows with VS Code and it could be separate projects. And basically you're just pinging between each of them as it's thinking. And so it's kind of juggling five chat windows at once.
Let's start with utility. I don't understand what it even means.
Everybody has some kind of utils in their head that they're calibrating.
There's hardly anything that hasn't been used for money.
In fact, there may be a fundamental problem in modeling what I want to model.
We have a beautiful podcast today. Just absolutely beautiful podcast. We have the Online Safety Act. Chris, you're going to be living the 411 on internet regulation. This shit does matter for games, though. There's actually a bunch of things that this ends up conditioning that I don't think people realize when you have verified parental consent, which we'll talk about what that means, what the Online Safety Act is.
I want to talk about drone warfare. Ukraine, there's a war going on, and they did a bunch of like game economy design stuff, I think is worth talking about.
That is a perfect game economist cast topic. I'll do Microsoft's downfall. But before we begin Microsoft's downfall, let's talk about what we've been playing.
Got a selection of good things on sale, stranger.
Chris, fresh from Croatia?
Yes. I downloaded a bunch of games for the flight that I never ended up playing. Instead, I just watched, what's that South Korean TV show that just came out on Netflix?
Squid Games.
Squid Games Season 3. I watched that, read some books, but haven't been playing a bunch of games. But I did recently acquire a cooperative board game called Lord of the Rings, The Fellowship of the Ring, the trick-taking game. So a nice mouthful there. It's a trick-taking game. So if you're not familiar with these types of games, these are like Euchre,
like
is a trick-taking game. Hearts is a trick-taking game. Basically, everybody plays a card down. Whoever has the highest card within the suit wins the trick. The way that modern board games have changed trick-taking is by giving players roles. Hey, your specific role is that you need to get exactly 3 of the tricks, or you need to get more than 3 tricks. So in that way, this game is not super innovative. It's a pretty straightforward trick-taking game. There's a single card that's like the trump card. It's the only trump card in the game, and it's the One Ring. But what's cool about it is obviously the Lord of the Rings theming. They got an extra $5 out of me just for that. But what's cool about it is it's a story game. So it really just walks you through the different chapters of the Fellowship of the Ring, and there's thematic episodes. So it's technically a legacy board game. So you're playing through this series of quests, and each one has like a theme. Now, the only real actual gameplay change that occurs with these different chapters is not, it doesn't really have to do with the actual trick taking. You're just taking tricks, and a 5 of kills is no different than a 5 of clubs. So that's not really interesting, but you get access to different characters, and each character has a different gameplay that will change the way that the game is played or the win condition. One character might say, draw a card from the threat deck, and there's these like black riders that are the threat decks. You draw a black rider card, and let's say it's a 3. You must win the 3 of clubs in this game. If you don't, you lose the game. So it's this cool, a bunch of different mechanics get added in over time. You get different characters, and the art is absolutely delightful. And it's based off the books. Not a video game, but a game, very cool game. And you can really see the board game industry juicing Lord of the Rings. Just like every other physical media company out there, Lego, let's see, Magic the Gathering, Lord of the Rings.
The Tolkien estate has just been a lot more liberal with licensing or something.
So I'm actually really curious, like, what happened, because I know that they had been pretty like strict about this kind of stuff.
So remember, there actually is a reason for this. So Middle Earth Enterprises got sold to Embracer Group, which is a Swedish operation out here who is rolling up a bunch of companies. They have now had their downfall. Their stock prices absolutely collapsed. They didn't deliver on their promises and the amount of capital that was invested in them. And so they spun off into three companies, one of which is a board game company. Another one is like the remaining Embracer groups. And the last one is Middle Earth Industries, which is now the owner of the token rights, the Lord of the Rings rights. And so they've been licensing back out because now they don't have to deal with the estate, which was notoriously stingy. And so that's why like the Amazon MMO of Lord of the Rings is back on. You saw EA come out with a squad RPG that kind of failed immediately. And I think you're seeing stuff like this.
I'm okay with them being more liberal as long as they don't like. So I'm going to be the guy who says that the Amazon TV show sucks. It's not good. They extrapolated on the story.
You won't be the first one to say that.
Yeah, I know it's not a controversial, but I love the use of the IP. Give me the characters I love. Tell me more about them. Yes, I want to have Samwise Gamgee as my character in this trick-taking game. Could I play this game with a standard deck of 52 cards? Probably. But I'd rather have a picture of Frodo Baggins sitting on the table. So I'm okay with it. I'm okay with this use of the IP, but it's just crazy how much is out there. There are three Lord of the Rings themed board games that have come out in the last 3 or 4 years that I saw at the store. This just happened to be the one that was like in the price range and kind of this experience that I was looking for. But yeah, really interesting to see them juicing. The board game industry is, I think it's doing okay.
Just no, given, it's doing great. It was the only profitable segment of Embracer.
Really?
Was the Asmodee, which was the board game company that they bought.
It's more than just Settlers of Catan and Monopoly and Pandemic. There's a Lord of the Rings Pandemic, I think, that came out. I could be wrong on that.
Dude, even though the library here, you can check out board games. And they've got a bunch of crash rooms, but they have good ones too. They've got stuff like Pandemic Legacy, and we played Mariposa's, like a butterfly migration game. Yeah, but I think board games are really hitting the mainstream. Yeah.
So,
Eric, what have you been up to? What have you been playing?
I guess I've been playing a ton of Once Upon a Galaxy. It's a drafting autobattler, very similar to Super Auto Pets, which I know this pod is a fan of.
Oh my God. Why didn't you tell me about this? You got to let me know about this immediately.
Yeah, no, it's great. I got hooked on it again, just like my first romance with Super Auto Pets. It's a little more complex, which is good. Got some Hearthstone Battlegrounds influence there. Interesting thing about this game is it was originally funded by Sam Bankman-Fried of FTX fame. It was his old college buddy who was like got into game design. And back then it was called Storybook Brawl. And in that Michael Lewis book, he actually talks about it. But yeah, so FTX was the funder for this game. And obviously FTX collapsed and they owned Storybook Brawl. And so the guy just rebooted the game, gave it a new name. It's called Once Upon a Galaxy, which is a strange name. But
not a crypto game.
Yeah. And I don't think either one involved crypto at any point. But yeah, it's basically crypto funded. But the game's good. We love to see subsidies for games we like. They are struggling to monetize. Yeah. So once you guys play it, I'd be curious to hear your take on how they're monetizing. I think this genre in general has had trouble monetizing because if you're drafting, you don't really own the cards, so it's less compelling to get them, that sort of thing. If not everyone's playing with the same set of cards, it doesn't really feel like you're playing a fair game, that sort of thing. But yeah, fun game. In the book, it talks about how Sam was in these $1 million investment meetings. He's just playing Storybook Brawl in his web browser. Yeah.
What's the new game, the new version called?
Once Upon a Galaxy.
Once Upon a Galaxy.
Yeah.
Free to play?
Yep. Very free. I've felt no pressure to monetize.
Is there a way to monetize?
Yeah, you'll see it when you get in there. But yeah, it's been fun. And I've been rollerblading a lot, I guess. That's actually what I've been doing lately.
Oh my God, the dream of the 90s is live.
The 90s is coming back.
Yeah. No, my daughter wanted to ice skate, and I was, all right, I'm going to buy you some rollerblades, and we're going to like rollerblade until you can stand up and skate around before I take you to the ice rink, because otherwise it's going to be a waste of time and money. And she did. And while she was doing it.
So economical.
And I was like, wait, this is fun. I want to do it too. So I got myself some skates.
Dude, I've been e-biking a lot lately. Like I didn't really have a strong desire to bike. I had a bike growing up. Didn't really give a shit about it. You put a motor on that thing and it's just like the whole world opens up. Yeah. We are amazing. Just get some wheels in your town.
Particularly in Stockholm, there's so much bike lane. They actually have these little bike police, which are hilarious. They'll flag people. They put these little their helmets. It's a whole thing.
The siren is just on their helmet, like a little light on there.
It's great. It's like very pop alert mall cop type shit.
Yeah. Wheel definitely top 10 invention list for me.
Yes. You know what? You know what, guys? In a Game Economist cast first, we are about to see live game footage figure out how to share my screen. Live in-game footage of what I've been playing. Ladies and gentlemen, it's Heroes of History. I have been addicted, and I love this game's thesis, and we should talk about it. So all of the characters that are in the public domain, you, of course, can use by definition. And so they basically have taken that thesis. And so you can play literally as the heroes of history. They made it a squad RPG. So my team, my five-star team is Sia.
Which?
Margaret the First of Denmark. Van Gogh. By the way, Karl Marx is down here. He's a two-star character. He's garbage, as you would expect.
Two stars. Where's Milton Friedman? Is he five?
So here's the thing. Like, I definitely want to reach out to this team. I think I could get Adam Smith in this game.
Oh,
John Locke
sure.
is here. I think John Stuart Mill could get in here, but yes. Adam Smith, I think Keynes has a shot here.
When you say in the public domain, these are like human beings that existed. What does that even mean? Do they have to be in the public domain?
So they're public figures,
but
and they don't like own their own likeness. Like you can't just go out and make, let's say, Kim Kardashian the glue game.
You can't just do that.
They own the rights to their likeness.
So when that crypto game. Off the grid, did the Donald Trump versus Kamala Harris like fight to the death video game mode? That was like illegal.
No, because it's parody. Parody is always allowed.
Oh, God. Beautiful.
That Supreme Court actually was a rule.
Wow.
Once Upon a Galaxy is the same thing, right? It's all like fairy tale characters. Yeah. You got a ton of IP to work with that people have resonance with, but you don't have to buy anything. Yeah.
Yeah.
There's a CCG that's doing this called Project O, which we talked about actually when we're at GDC amongst the three of us, which I also am like in love with. But they're also going with fictional characters like Frankenstein. And this is all, I love this because not only do you have these heroes of history, literally, but the other thing that is in this game is this whole builder aspect. So this is like an old loop. Normally squad RPGs have moved away from this, where you would have these base building elements and you'd have these characters and how they're looped together, and they go back to this old design. The thing that's really cool is that as you do more research, you move through these research trees. And when you're done with a research tree, you move to a new civilization. So right now you start at the Stone Age and you'll go all the way to the High Middle Ages, and they're adding more and more worlds, and you see where they're going to take this. They are going to run out of runway, right?
When they run out of time.
They're going to have to go to the future. Yeah, they're going to have to go to the future.
Mars, Jupiter, what are the difference?
But then you're going to lose all your emotional connection.
No, I just flip to a different civilization. Yeah. This is all European stuff, right? It's just a new track in Asia or something.
That's very true. They could also do things like Wakanda forever. So they can do some of that, but I think they can. The thing that's nice is that you may move through histories in the city building aspect because it's a linear progression, but you can have characters that are competitive from any age. You're not restricted to that. So even though that I started the game, let's say in the Stone Ages, you can still get characters who are more modern. That is a completely different track, which is really nice. So they don't place any preconditions on that. So, I could ride John Locke into the sunset.
So other than the characters, that's their edge, is that they've got these kind of historical characters.
It's the historical characters in the historical setting. So right now we're looking at a live ops event that's actually Viking based. And funny enough, I actually went to Norway. I'm in Sweden, but Norway actually has a lot of the good Viking shit. And there are these Viking churches. And one of the things that you have in this live ops event that's a Scandinavian themed Viking building event is that you can actually build one of the churches. They have the design, which you can see right here. You see the third one, the luxurious home, this three stacking of roofs. And for those who aren't watching the YouTube version, it looks almost like a Japanese architectural design, but closing in at the top parts. And when you see these in Norway, they actually have these like dragon parts to torture. It's mm-hmm. really fucking cool. But it's a very unique appeal. It's a very unique game. It's going back to this kind of thesis that I thought had been abandoned about having a city building aspect and having the heroes. I do hope they don't get too stuck in the city building aspect. I have concerns about it. Their gacha actually sucks. Like, their velocity is really low. I'm not pulling a lot of characters. I'm not rolling a lot of characters. I'm not feeding characters into other characters. There's some mistakes I think they make that I could go on and on about. But the core idea of having these heroes of history, I think, is extremely unique and is a ton of fun.
So how much have you spent?
I have spent $200.
Jesus.
Monetization sucks.
Yeah,
their monetization is really bad. So to give you an example, like, what is one of the best monetization windows for them? It is when you enter a new era and you want to jumpstart. And so they do have starter packs. The problem is that the starter packs are almost very little relation to what is actually happening when I start a new world. Like, I don't have a sense of predictable value from that. It's basically just a bunch of resources that have been discounted. I wanted something that gave me more research points. So the thing that I really want to point out about their economic design, I will have a blog post going through all their loops, is that they have research points, which is what controls you moving through the different ages. And research points are generated on a regular schedule for all players. Every 30 minutes, you're getting a research point. And so what you really want to do is you want to log in every 30 minutes and you want to deposit your research points into the research trees. And then after you deposit your research points, then you have to spend resources to unlock it. So there's two costs. So you're going in here and dumping your points every so often based on how fast they regenerate and how many points you can hold, quote, in your wallet. And so this is the central bottleneck for all progression. This is how they pace players. They know if they can control your research points, they can control your research trees. And research trees basically influence the level cap of all your buildings. The level cap of all your buildings really influences how far you can go with your characters. And so you can see that they've created this really nice economic loop. Although it needs some refinement, they have some good levers at their disposal by having a central bottleneck.
They don't sell the heroes?
They do. They sell hard currency that you can use to do gacha rolls. It's just that the pulls are very expensive and there's very little that you can do with duplicate. They have this awakening system, but usually you would expect to be doing hundreds of pulls in this game. And I've done maybe 10 or 15.
Yeah.
They're stingy too.
I struggle with these kinds of games because how do you choose the one that you're going to play forever? I look at this and I agree there are some interesting thematic elements, but it looks like a reskin of a bunch of different games that I've seen in the past. A lot of businesses like this, I don't know, create a moat. Other than, this person spent two.
I don't think there's list to play it for. Yeah, I think you're supposed to cycle between them. You play one until the progression gets stale and you play another.
Every company wants you to play forever so they can continue to grow your LTV, right? That's just how they make profit, is LTV minus CPI. I think exactly to your point, Chris, is that there's very few moats on mobile, and I think it has a lot of resemblance to a perfectly competitive market. Part of it's just path dependency, transaction costs, all the normal things we think about in markets. But yeah, look what's happened with Match 3. Royal Match, Candy Crush, all these games were successful. A bunch of new ones flooded. And those games still retained. I think there was a sense of maybe a little bit of path dependency, but they also they invest massively in those products. There is a material difference, I can tell you, between Candy Crush and a smaller team. This thing called Adaptive Drop, how they handle seeds. They are doing a lot of incredible things.
When you say path dependency, you mean first to market matters, the order and what do you mean by path dependency?
No. Only in the sense that if I start a new squad RPG, something with linear power progression, that means I have to restart at the beginning of the track. And so I think there's some path dependency that once I'm deeper into an RPG, the lock-in is not the right word. But is it easier for me to code in Python or in R? I'm path dependent at this point because I've been spending so much time in R.
Yeah, it's sunk cost or whatever.
Cool. Looks cool. But every time I see one of these games, I'm I don't know. Why wouldn't I play one of the other, the most popular squad RPG? Although this looks more like a Civilization game than a squad RPG.
I think it's got some Civilization vibes. It's very astute observation, Chris. Sorry, I take it back. Karl Marx was now three stardom.
Have a fixed star level, or is it there's different? You could roll Karl Marx at any star level.
So it's interesting. I have not seen the ability for you to star up these characters, which is also something that you normally do with duplicates. Is they're able to star them up to the star cap, which is not the case. What duplicates do here is that it goes to something called the Awaken, which is, again, just more vertical progression, which I've also been disappointed with, which is, again, really another good point, Eric. This is one of the reasons their gacha, I think, is bad.
He's a ranged character, but he's got a sickle and a hammer. Terrible game design.
Also, do you see his class as Manipulator?
That makes sense. I like that.
Is the hammer and sickle even a Marx thing? Didn't the Russians do that? I guess it's thematically linked. It's cool, but
it's fair enough. It's close enough.
Okay, who do you want from the econ list to go in here?
Adam Smith is the most famous, but
let's put it this way. Who do you guys want? You get one pick. I won't limit to
more time.
I want recognizability, so I would say Marx and Smith are the two big ones.
That's fair. That's fair. Yeah. I think John Maynard Keynes would be really cool here because he also was super tall. I think he could be a very interesting character.
Is Keynes very recognizable, though?
Oh, absolutely. That mustache. I don't even know what he looks like. He was like 6'4".
I know what Adam Smith looks like because I've seen my PFP is him, but it's just an old dude, an old fancy dude. People are like, oh, I know him.
It's going to be hilarious when they get more modern. Dude, you know what? I want to rip with Bill Clinton. Who doesn't want Bill Clinton on the team?
You think Clinton's making the list?
The Democrats.
Dude, Bill Clinton's totally making the list, man.
Adam Smith is probably the best choice. I can't really think of anybody. If I could choose a modern person, it'd be Daron Acemoglu.
I am disappointed at the lack of American Revolutionary War. That's not true. I saw Thomas Jefferson was in here.
It's George Washington.
Only TJ right now. Only TJ.
Yeah, they're going to release Washington as part of an event, and he'll be
I really won't fucking want. So Thomas Jefferson's ability is called Founders Pack. forms a spirit link with the enemy hero possessing the highest HP lasting for 6 seconds. Linked 45% of any damage Thomas receives is transferred to the linked enemy hero.
What's the theme cool. here?
I don't get is that thematic? Do you remember
the famous flag? Or what was it that Ben Franklin said? We either hang together or we hang separately.
Yeah, but this is a pact with the enemy team.
Yeah.
And that was Ben
this
Franklin.
This is like damage sharing with the enemy team.
Yeah,
it should have gone. They missed an opportunity to do Alexander Hamilton. He's got much better name recognition with these young kids.
You know what, Chris? I think you're right.
I would like an Alexander Hamilton.
Dude, my six-year-old knows TJ. He doesn't know. She doesn't know Hamilton. She knows.
She doesn't know Alexander Hamilton.
But knows Second Julia.
But they teach TJ in school. He's on the fucking Mount Rushmore. He's on the
queen. So what about Sacagawea?
I'm surprised she's on here. I think they just wanted diversity.
She's been fading.
If you want to talk about historical impact, like, she's pretty low, to be honest.
I'd agree with that. Oh, you know what? They need John Smith and was John Smith married to Pocahontas? No, John Smith is
no,
a
that
real
is true.
Person.
That's true. That's true. No, that yeah. is true. That is true. I think you're right.
John Smith is a real person. It didn't happen the way that
that's
it happened
true.
In the movie.
That's true.
But
yeah.
He was a real person.
You're right. I can see.
Jesus. This is fun.
And she did go back to England too. I remember seeing those pictures.
It's crazy.
It's interesting, like, what characters they choose to include and what not, because I think there's a lot of really interesting political decisions you actually have to make. For instance, Otto von Bismarck gets there. Karl Marx gets there. Like, these are not Cyprus the Great. Like, these are not always, like, savory figures.
No? But they're of big importance. No one would disagree.
But I'm saying, like, okay, how much can we push the limit?
I'm
can Pol Pot be in here?
Like, I don't think Pol Pot's of that historical significance. Nowhere close to Marx.
What about Mao? Would you put Mao in here?
Wolfgang, I'm sorry. Mao,
if it could be a
he's a five star character.
Civ character, it could be in here.
Dude, there he is, man.
Ben Franklin.
Hercules is in here somehow. I don't think Hercules is a...
He may have been like a person technically or
something. No, Lancelot is here.
So they
do have Washington. Washington is in here.
Look at that. Robin Hood. They've got fantasy characters.
Yeah.
William Wallace.
Medusa, definitely a real person. Dude, it's only a matter of time. I do the little characters of famous people. Abe Lincoln. I knew they would have Abe Lincoln.
Yeah.
That's a good call. Florence Nightingale is a healer, of course.
They got FDR in here.
Is a wheelchair. Yeah. Oh, Jesus. We're going straight to hell.
That's just the tree. He was in a wheelchair.
That'd be really funny to see him fight.
That's all it takes. I can't get into these games. I feel like I see behind the veil, do you know what I mean? I'm just like, this is a path to nothing.
Oh, why do you think it's different in the other games you play?
I play games where I like the decision making, where like they challenge me to make decisions, and if I make the wrong decision, I fail.
So that is the case. It's not just grinding. That is one component of it, but there is labor and there is capital. So to give you one example, like one of the main key progression funnels is the PvP environment. And so what squad you choose to compose, because there's Rochambeau. So if you see here, there's
How much of this is like chores and grinding, and how much of this is like actual interesting? You're like, oh yeah, great, we got rock, paper, scissors. Yeah. Fire Emblem's been doing this forever.
So that's fair, but what I think that does is it guarantees you progression in the long run, whereas it isn't always the case that, like, I could be stuck at the same rank in some of these games for a really long time. And if the game is fun enough, I think that you have to figure out how to satiate you as long as you're not progressing and getting better as a player. And I think that's very tough for a lot of players.
Yeah, like, for me, I've played enough competitive games and know what being bad is like that I'm like, I'm fine just being bad and continuing to play as long as I enjoy the game. I guess that's not true for a lot of people.
Yep.
So you have that illusory progression. But
so to give you an example, this is 4,800 diamonds for 10 summons. That's $48. That's crazy. That's extremely expensive for gacha.
So how does a summon work? Is this just to use them once?
It's a straight loot box. So you have a probability of getting a different character. You can see, like, here I have 1.2%.
Oh, 10 loot boxes is $48.
Correct.
So a loot box is $5. And this gives you a chance of winning a single character.
Correct. You're guaranteed a character. The question is just what character are you going to get?
Yeah, that's insane.
A 3-star, 4-star, 5-star character.
You get the same character twice?
You can, and remember, it goes through that awaken system. So you can upgrade your single character by getting a dupe. Normally, that's what stars them up, to Eric's point.
Pretty expensive.
It's extremely expensive. I think this is one of the problems with the game. And honestly, I think they could hold prices constant. The problem is that they don't have a lot of reoccurring money sinks. Like, we're talking about those new starter bundles. They don't really work. The other thing that they don't have is these annuities we've talked about. basically I pay an upfront fee and I get a stream of hard currency payments every single day. Like they have one version of this, but it's for the gacha. It's for Stanima. It's not a very good deal. And I wish I could stack these.
Let's just smash through this Microsoft downfall.
So if you guys have not been following the news, Microsoft and particularly the Xbox, really want to talk about the Xbox division, is in a really bad place. And so what's going on? Didn't they just acquire Activision King Blizzard? They're acquiring all these studios and then there's all these layoffs. What's going on? The headline story is that they bet on Game Pass, which is their game subscription service. I've been very anti-game subscription because it's antithesis to how people consume gaming content, which is increasingly them playing less games over time, not more games in the sense they're getting attached to a live service game. So that instantly cuts your TAM at the margin because this is most valuable to people who consume lots of games. Because their savings is however much the cost of the games would be relative to the price they're paying in monthly subscription. Honestly, we can make that an opportunity cost, then they're going to consume more because now they're in a zero marginal cost network if they're in a subscription. But they've been spending a lot of time on this that, again, is antithesis to where games are in terms of, I would argue, content consumption. There's also the resistance to gamers to not being able to own their content. Which, I mean, we can go back and forth on the definition of owning, whether or not it's a license or not. But people have this idea of wanting to build your digital library. Like building your Steam collection is something that I think is recognized as really positive. And that's one of the reasons Epic's Game Store started to do those free giveaways, is you're starting to build your library on an Epic Game Store. So even if you don't play those games, which everyone jokes about, just building the library, I think, gives you a little bit of lock-in in some sense, although it doesn't feel like it. It's just where your digital library is, so to speak. And I would say the thing that I just can't get over is that they weren't able to ever provide an answer for why all these other game subscription services failed. So you guys remember OnLive?
I remember ads for it. I never used it.
OnLive was your game streaming service through via the cloud. They had a subscription service. You could also buy full price games for them, but they had a subscription service. Genkai ended up getting bought by PlayStation. They just do game streaming right now, but they were trying to dabble in this. Gamefly, if you remember that, was almost Netflix for this, and digital pivoted into a digital environment. It's just very hard. It's very hard to get this right. And if you don't have something like MTX also supporting it and a strong element of MTX, then it's hard to also have recurring revenue. You're just giving away too much content. And so they've been focusing on Game Pass, which has been a total failure. Like they stopped reporting monthly active pass users, which is a huge, obviously, component to any subscription services, how many MAU you have. So if you start hiding that, it's not a good sign. I think it was like 35 million was the last they mentioned. But the most crucial factor of their downfall is they're not selling Xboxes anymore, is that Xbox has collapsed in Europe. It never had a foothold in Asia, but it's collapsed in Europe and PlayStation has taken over. That is the single thing that is the most harmful to Xbox's division. And that's caused the cascade of all these other things. But the point that regulators... This is what really frustrates me about regulation, is that the UK Competition Authority, if you guys remember, when Microsoft announced it was buying Activision King Blizzard, dragged their feet forever on getting this merger approved. So did the FTC, which, by the way, abandoned its final lawsuit, finally, a couple weeks ago, about this merger, which has happened a while ago. They were still trying to go back and have it undone. But the CMA basically diddled around because they thought Microsoft acquiring this gaming company would be a monopolistic potential activity and threaten future innovation in the cloud gaming market. Does anyone understand what the cloud gaming market is? What is that? This is always the antitrust game, is like defining market segments. And they somehow had the unilateral authority to give it this very small market segment. And although they did eventually approve it, the fact that they dilled for so long on this harmed Microsoft's ability to get this Game Pass strategy going and see it at its best. And even if I didn't believe in it, it should have had the shot. It should have had its best possible shot. And we as a games industry are all worse because of this, because they didn't have their best shot. And regulators will never take accountability for this, even though there was no threat to cloud gaming. They'll never look back on this and be like, wow, as Microsoft shedding employees, do we take any responsibility? No, never. And this is what really frustrates the regulators.
Do you think the regulators are what caused it to fail?
I think it harmed their ability in terms of having success, or reduced their probability. And I think if you're a regulator, even if there's a real market threat, like I'm not debating whether or not there was a market threat or there was, but I think what they had to be was swift, and they were not swift. And that would be my criticism more than anything.
That's how crypto people feel about regulation. They're like, oh, we got all fucked over because there was no clarity.
Yeah.
The only cloud economics out there was Roblox. And I don't think Roblox is going to be touched by Microsoft. They weren't in threat of this. I'm curious. So do you attribute the failure of Microsoft? So regulation aside, sounds like the hardware component is playing a big role here. And what?
Yes.
Why is PlayStation so much better off than Xbox?
I think it depends on like how far down the causal chain we want to go. Like, why is Microsoft not selling hardware units in Europe anymore? I would argue it's because they've basically had a collapse of first-party software. So like, when's the last time Halo was a relevant franchise? That's a franchise that's been a disaster. Remember they bought Gears of War from Epic? That was another capstone.
Oh, yeah.
That was another capstone project that's basically gone nowhere. Like, all of their studios they've acquired haven't produced Rare games. You remember Rare? Fucking Rare? Perfect Dark Zero? Where is it? Got canceled as a part of this. They've been working on Perfect Dark forever.
I remember that trailer.
Yep. So it's just been under delivery. Starfield did not do as well as it should have. Remember they bought ZeniMax? That was a part of this expansion as well. And so like, they just haven't had the consistent delivery they've needed relative to Sony, which is killing it left and right. Look at Spider-Man. Selling. All these single player, high budget games do really well on PlayStation.
Do we think that does Xbox just kill their console? Like the Xbox console?
They've been trying to. They don't want to be in the hardware business. This is what Xbox Anywhere was about.
Like, without their hardware, what are they? Like
a game streaming service and a game publisher. That's it.
I would not use Xbox if it weren't for the console.
Like, exactly.
I would not use them. It's kind of
I think this is it, guys. I think it's over.
It's done.
So what have they done so far? You said they've stopped hardware sales in Europe. They've done the layoffs. You said they're pulling out of Europe. So like they're literally not selling Xboxes in Europe anymore.
They've declined in Europe. They've declined in terms of sales of Europe. And I forget the regions, but they are pulling back on advertising in some regions as well. Not all of Europe.
And then your prediction is that they'll cut console hardware altogether at some point in the near
future. Yeah, I don't think Xbox is consistent with Microsoft's broader company strategy either. And if it's not making as much money as it should, like it'll be gone. It'll be sold for pieces.
So it's time to upgrade to PlayStation. I'm going to be a PlayStation Mac person by the end of the year. That's insane. I was a PC Xbox guy. My whole world torn apart. In terms of PlayStation's monetization model, don't they also have a subscription though?
They do. They do.
Why,
they do.
Why is this but working?
It's not the centerpiece of their world. And the way PS Plus works is different. So PS Plus is their subscription service. Yeah. It does great money. But what happens is every month they give games away and you claim them. But you have to be there in the month subscribing to claim them and add them to your library. If you don't continue to subscribe, you lose it. It's actually like a really nice little behavioral, again, meta collection tactic. Little endowment effect.
If you, let's say I'm a subscriber in July, I claim the game, and then I unsubscribe in August, can I still play that game?
No. You have to have an active subscription to be accessed to your collected library.
Okay. So it's like the Xbox library. It just doesn't, like, the Xbox library, it's like always in and out.
It's persistent. Like Netflix is a persistent library. This is two games that you're claiming every month.
I don't know.
I think it's a fascinating mechanic for sure.
But I guess what are you paying for in that model, in the PlayStation model? Like in the Xbox model, I tell myself that I'm paying for like free games. And
here's the thing, it gets more valuable the longer you subscribe, right? Because you're collecting more games, which builds your library. And so every month you're paying for access to a growing library.
Is there an online component? Do you have to pay for online chatting with your friends?
No, I think everyone's gotten rid. I forget what PlayStation
Xbox
was.
Xbox has not gotten rid of it. It's annoying.
You can for free to play games though.
Yeah, I had to. Every time I get a new game on Xbox, I have to resubscribe to Xbox Live so I can talk to my friends while I'm playing it. Like Night Rain, I had to buy the game for $40, and then I had to resubscribe for a month while I played it and beat it, and then I unsubscribed. Like annoying to have to deal with.
Can you play on without subscribing, or is it just for the voice chat?
You cannot play online without subscribing unless it's like a free-to-play game like Fortnite or Rocket League, which I've always found infuriating. So we're just going to go full circle and just go back to premium games, box price, you buy your PlayStation, you buy Spider-Man for $70, and then you play Spider-Man for 50 hours, and then you go on to the next thing.
Yep.
So what does console look like if it's just PlayStation and Switch? They don't even compete directly that much.
Yeah,
either.
It's like there's no competition for PlayStation in this model.
Exactly. This is not good for games publishers. This means they will be more extractive because you're now bouncing off between Steam and Sony. That's it. That's what this world looks like. That's scary.
Yeah.
That's grim, actually. It's great. Do you think, I'm sure that the mainstream story will be that Microsoft or Xbox like killed, like corporate America killed Xbox, corporate America killed ABK, like all these franchises that were good. You mentioned Gun Guys, the big bulky football
looking
Gun Guys. Gears of War.
Yeah. Big Gun
Guys. Yeah, I actually played that not too recently or not too long ago. It was just like terrible management, just like a horrible misunderstanding of the medium.
I think Phil mentioned like there was a bunch of bad acquisitions, right? They acquired a bunch of rising star companies that failed to deliver after they were acquired, like Rare, like Bethesda, Bungie.
Just feels like it happened so quick. Like it all happened within a decade. I guess that's not that quick, but it seems like you'd be able to point to...
My guess
like,
is a lot of bad bets during ZERP also probably hurt them as well. They went like way too hard into this whole Game Pass thing. They reoriented the whole strategy around Game Pass and then it failed, right? Like the ABK acquisition seems super questionable to me, especially to Phil's point. People play fewer games and they play them for longer, which reduces the value proposition of Game Pass. ABK games, Call of Duty, Candy Crush, World of Warcraft, these are games you play singularly for an extremely long time. It totally does not fit in the subscription model. Yeah, I don't know.
Is there a way to do away with subscriptions and just start... I don't know.
Subscriptions are just, they're not. See, here's the other thing. If you're on the publisher side, they try to do engagement-based payouts. But as we know, like time spent is not the same as willingness to pay. So there's all this attribution problem, because the other thing you've got to remember is that all these publishers who get onto these subscription platforms also have their own deals, which sometimes have minimum guarantees. So these pots get carved up in very weird ways. And sometimes, even though you might have a high share game, you could be getting a low payout. So I think there's this, we could call it like a principal agent problem that doesn't exist, I think, at a different market. Because the thing is that you're actually like employing a different principal, right? Like I'm actually employing Microsoft when I own a subscription to be my content distribution decision maker on what they expose to me, how they go out and make media purchasing decisions. Or normally I put that onus on me. Right. And then I just have zero marginal cost access to their network, what they put on the platform.
Yeah. I almost wonder if they should just move to an Apple model, like an Apple App Store, and just, hey, we're going to take 20% of everything you make on our platform and just let the businesses deal with the monetization. It's almost like a central plan monetization, whereas each project should probably be optimizing its monetization based on markets, as opposed to us trying to slap this subscription model over 10,000 different games. 1,000 different genres. Just say, hey, okay, we're moving to a 25% cut of all your revenue or profit or whatever it might be is coming to us now. We're doing away with subscriptions. Players can, maybe there's some sort of minimum subscription thing, but take the Apple route. So much less work.
Yeah, sounds good.
You don't have to manage this stupid library.
I'm not against that.
But it sounds like it really does come down to content, though. Like they don't have...
I think it's just poor execution.
Have a moat around their consoles, because there's nothing unique to an Xbox that you can't get with a PlayStation.
Look, I would say that Game Pass, I think, would be the least of their worries if they delivered on their first-party acquisition studios, delivering regular beats into their franchises the way Sony did. That's what brings all the boys to the yard. It's content. This isn't that hard.
And well, remember,
I think the tech part of them has always strayed, right? Because they're always just like a field experiment for Microsoft. Remember Kinect? Remember the video bar that you would put out? Remember how they were going to have digital rights management where you would connect? There were so many mistakes that they've made, I think, as a tech company. To be honest with you, they're one of the few tech companies that ended up persisting for this long. But once they're gone, that's also, by the way, one of the last vestiges of tech companies in games. Every other attempt has been thwarted. And Sony is, could we call it a tech company? I think it's so many things. It's a Japanese conglomerate, by the way, you know, Japanese economics and these interlocking companies. It's its own thing, by the way, Japanese economics and how their regulatory regime has created these like monstrosities in lifetime employment. But yeah, this is also a big browbeat back for tech and games too.
Speaking of destruction and war of companies, Eric put out a pretty lovely brief article on game economics.
In case you haven't heard, there's a war going on in Ukraine, among other wars. And one of the major facets of this war is the emphasis on drone warfare. Those like autonomous little quadcopter things you fly around. Turns out you strap a bomb to them, fly them at somebody, kills people. Military theorists have hypothesized about the value of drones in tactical warfare for a long time. And this is the first major conflict where both sides are actually making active use of drone and anti-drone technology. So there's a lot of like military eyes on this. Ukraine in particular is fighting Russia. Russia has a large manpower advantage. Ukraine has a bunch of financial and technological backing from the West. They're not sending in people. And so Ukraine is making heavy use of drones. And one of the major news headlines that broke recently was Ukraine has been using this point system, which resembles a video game, to incentivize their pilots. And it works like this. So military targets are assigned points. If you kill a soldier, a foot soldier, an infantryman, it's worth 5 points. If you kill a tank, it's worth, I don't know, 30 points. If you kill like a rocket truck, it's worth 50 points. If you destroy like a, you know, a military facility, it's worth like 200 points. Targets have points. And then the drone pilots are given the freedom to choose their targets, and they rack up points for their squadron based on what targets they kill. The platoons that have the highest point totals are celebrated. There's a famous one called the Birds of Magyar. They're like one of the top drone platoons in Ukraine. And also, you can redeem these points for additional drone equipment. So they can say, oh, we really want a bunch of these like heavy bomber drones because we want to go after like the tanks. So they might purchase those with their points. Similar to...
No fucking way. No fucking way. There's an in-game store?
Yeah, exactly. Dude,
you got to read Eric's article. It's pretty quick, but it's pretty interesting. Okay. I learned some stuff.
And Ukraine is crediting this with massively improving the efficiency of their drone program. And yeah. There's a lot of belly aching about, oh, video games, you shouldn't be using video games to kill people, blah, blah, blah. But I want to sidestep that and just talk about why is this so effective from an economics perspective. So one is just that it's like a free market. On the drone supply side, the platoon knows best what types of equipment they need, right? They'll say, oh, we actually want to go for a lot of infantry targets, so we want to use this type of drone. Or, oh, hey, this type of drone would be good, but the price is too high, and so actually we'll purchase this other type instead. And this offers a lot of information back up the supply chain to the manufacturers who say, oh, this type of drone is super high demand. This one people aren't buying, so we should shift our production accordingly. And this is like market prices dictating like what to produce. And again, this is very different from traditional military supply where it's top down. Okay, logistics, this many guns goes to this troop, this many boots goes to this group. And so this market for equipment actually helps them decide what types of drones to build. And this is especially useful in a situation with a new technology where the commanders might not necessarily know which type of drone is actually most useful, but the boots on the ground really do. So there's this free market element to it that makes it more efficient. There's also just this incentive alignment component where you got to imagine the drone pilots, they're told, hey, go kill stuff. And they're like, okay, what do I kill? Should I kill the soldier or should I kill the tank? I think I can almost certainly kill the soldier. Maybe there's a 30% chance I kill the tank. What do I do? In the absence of guidance like this, you might expect I'd expect these novice drone pilots to behave like a novice Call of Duty player, where if you ever watched a newbie play a shooter, they just run in and go for kills. They have no regard for strategic importance. They're not like, oh, this is a critical location, so I need to hold it. They're like, no, oh, there's a head, let me shoot it. And also, they tend not to care about their own death. They'll tend to just chase that adrenaline rush of getting a kill with no disregard for their ratio. And this creates a very explicit, okay, here's the explicit trade-off, okay? If they have a 20% chance of killing the tank or 100% chance of killing the soldier, you should go for the tank. These point values help inform down the line what they should be prioritizing. And on top of that, these point values are adjusted dynamically based on battlefield conditions. So maybe in a certain terrain, let's say it's mountainous and tanks are less useful, but foot soldiers are more useful, they might change their point values and say, okay, foot soldiers are worth 6 points now instead of 5. And this is very similar to a game designer saying, oh, killing goblins is now worth 7 XP instead of 6 because we want to encourage going for goblins instead of orcs or whatever. Yeah. And so
is the idea here to give some basic, like you're basically building a utility function for drones on the fly and then trusting the drone to execute against the utility function?
Exactly. Yeah. Whereas in the past, the utility function was just a command, right? Just do this. Mm. Now it's, okay, here's the utility function and you, agent, optimize against this utility function.
So I guess if it's spotted multiple targets, it might think of something, an expected value meets traveling salesman problem of, okay, I could take out this 5 point right here. And then based on this distance, it could be a 2 point. But if I go straight instead of left, my expected value of getting this target is 50%. You can do a lot of modeling to get this done, a lot of optimization.
Right? And like that stuff is the kind of stuff I think players or these drone pilots intuitively do. You fly out, you see a soldier, you're like, okay, maybe there's a tank over there. Maybe there's not. Should I scout for an additional target or should I take the one I have? That decision is hard to make formally, but it's something that pilots will intuitively start to learn to do and get better at. You see this, I believe in this kind of evolutionary optimization where like you just get a lot of different people. You give them the same incentive structure, but let a lot of people loose. Some of them will find better strategies, and then those strategies will start to proliferate, and the system as a whole gets better at doing it, rather than the top-down sort of command mm-hmm. structure.
The reward pool is just upgraded equipment, or do they have things like food, cigarettes, I don't know, swag? Are there other things? What's a part of the...
I know that it's a mix of just military honors. You're like, we're the top scoring squadron and everyone gets a medal, that kind of stuff. And that's, mm-hmm. we've seen that before. The ace pilot with the most confirmed kill counts gets like a purple heart or whatever. But I think it's interesting that the shopping component of, oh, and I can also spend these points. These points are spent at a platoon level, so it's not individuals. So I don't think that they're buying cigarettes with them. I think they're buying specifically drone equipment.
That'd be interesting, though. Improve the reward pool. Do you get, because if a point can't buy anything, then maybe I care less about the points. They're purely psychological versus, oh, I can buy a better drone or a better bomb or a better weapon. I think it's kind of interesting. I'm curious. Yeah. I'm curious if they could improve results by improving the reward pool.
I think you want the reward pool to be reinvested into the objective, right? It's like in a game where you have multiple currencies. One currency is only used for like upgrades, right? And the other currency is used for like gacha pulls or something.
Yeah, that's fair.
Yeah.
I think you want to win, though. Even when I sometimes look at like how NFL contracts are done, which there's a lot of incentive-based NFL contracts, the thing that's interesting is they don't get hyper-specific. They don't, like, a lot of the, first of all, they're set like almost always 1 or 2 years in advance, like incentive-based metrics. And they're always based on like very clear flat amounts. And there's sometimes team-based goals, get to the Super Bowl. Maybe there might be something like get to 2,000 yards, but it's play 50% of games. It's very rarely performance-based, which I found interesting. Because football has so many diverse strategies that they don't want to optimize the wrong thing and crowd out what should be important. Like, it's very hard to get, I think, internal incentives like within a corporation, because you can screw them up too, right? Definitely like incentivizing something, you can make something worse. I absolutely believe that to be the case. You can distort things in a way that you shouldn't. So I guess I'm curious like how they evolve this institution, because ultimately they want to win, right? Like the whole point of all these systems is that it helps them win. So what's the systems design that wins, I think becomes the question. Even if like things are dynamically changing, they're still building an infrastructure on top of that.
Yeah. Yeah. And ultimately, like, it's when a corporation sets incentives like that, it's still like a command economy where rather than telling soldiers what to do, they're fixing prices. A soldier, you know, infantry is worth 5 points, right? A tank is worth 30 points. And they still have to adjust those fixed prices to some optimal level. And yeah, I imagine that's probably a struggle for them. And they probably have people looking at these numbers in aggregate and trying to figure out how to tune things, just like your game designer has to tune your loot tables. I say it's a free market. It's like more of it's a market with fixed prices that the economy designer adjusts. And yeah, I don't know what their process is, but I got to imagine that's a big part of optimizing it. And if you set the point system wrong, you could create all sorts of weird outcomes. One thing worth noting, though, on the perversion side is the nice thing about drones in particular is they all have cameras on them, right? Because the pilot needs the camera to fly. And so the camera doubles as like a confirm kill confirmation. So you can see the tank blew up on the camera.
Oh, you get the feedback loop.
Exactly. Yeah. So this prevents things where you glitch the system into thinking you got a billion points when you didn't. Is that like the commanders actually
you
review
think there could
footage.
Be fraud?
Yeah, no, there could definitely be fraud. Yeah.
We know there's fraud with kills during war. That's actually fairly common. Oh my God.
And so the camera provides that confirmation.
So they basically they have an agent monitoring as well.
Yeah. And no, with no additional equipment costs, because they already have the camera feed. Yeah,
that's right.
It's interesting because we're talking about organizational structure and like this kind of, you call it a market, this kind of like rewarding individuals for their level of effort or level of output. Just like in this setting where you have to have these specific conditions, you need to be able to observe the output, the quantity of the output, and attribute that output to a specific user. You have the same issue in a normal org where it's sometimes more difficult to attribute revenue or profit to a specific individual. It's a little bit easier in like big organizations where you have lines of code and engineers. But I just think it's interesting, like this type of competitive approach works for this environment with drones, but it wouldn't work if you were soldiers, feet on the ground, guns, no cameras. It's funny, the analogy.
Fascinating article, Eric.
Yeah.
Absolutely fascinating. This was an incredible find and analysis.
Yeah, shout outs to Arakli, who actually pointed me towards this. He was like, hey, this is super interesting. You want to write about it? It's like, oh, damn, this is crazy. There's a similar point system that doctors use for how they, when they see patients, they get points based on what type of visit is and what happened. And I'm pretty sure it's causing all sorts of perverse behavior.
I was going to say, that sounds like the opposite of what you want.
Have you heard about the value of statistical life?
No.
I've heard that term before.
Oh, my God. So, man, we could talk about how regulatory frameworks... Yeah. So basically what happens is that there have been regulations passed. It's not as bad as people would imagine in the U.S. government, where there's any regulation that's proposed to have an economic impact. I think it's 100 million or more has to go through a cost benefit analysis. And that's why there's so many economists in D.C. And I was one of them, too. They basically have been hired to farm out all these cost benefit analysis. It's amazing. Okay, what goes into a cost benefit analysis for a regulatory framework? And like, how do you actually figure about that? What does the agency want? But ultimately, like, for instance, when you're considering some safety regulation, how do you start to quantify some of that in cost benefit analysis? We have something called the value of statistical life, which is very similar to what Eric mentioned, which is basically, yeah, you want to save as many life years as possible. And we can debate whether or not each life year is equal. People are surprised to learn that these frameworks exist. And it's only, they seem to be fine when they're under operation, because I think they are fairly good at what they do. But as soon as they know about it, there's just like all these riots.
Do you, what is the value of Statistical Life right now?
Oh, so let's look it up.
I'm going to guess 1.8 million because I'm doing 30 working years.
It's age adjusted.
The median, but it's an average, right? It's just like,
well, you could average it.
Is it? So it varies by.
Okay. It is for analysis using, no, it's set at the agency level. We all have to use the same calculations. So analysis using a 2024 base year, VSL or the value of statistical life is 13.7 million.
Yeah, 10X.
Whoa. It's 13.7 and EPA, it looks like Ken set their own and they have it at 91.
I am evil. Oh my God. Is it that much? That seems really high.
Yeah. It's like, so it's trying to say how much people are willing to pay to reduce their risk of dying. Like they are trying to do this the right way.
So this is inferred from like insurance purchasing behavior or what?
Yeah, that's a part of it. There's a lot of like pretty hokey methods you use to try to get at this. A lot of it is gymnastics, to be honest with you.
Median wage and multiplied by 30.
And I would also say it's very interesting to me that in all the analysis I end up doing, very few of the costs end up weighing the benefits, which is very interesting for the regulatory state.
Speaking of health outcomes, let's talk about...
Let's talk about porn. So the UK just... passed a while ago the Online Safety Act 2023, also known as the Act. And basically what this does is it protects users of internet users from damaging illegal content. Illegal content duties are now in effect. Criminal offenses if you do expose people to illegal content or harmful content. And illegal content is the typical stuff you'd imagine: inciting violence, racism, fraud, extreme pornography, CSAM, any of that type of horrible stuff. That's not super interesting. It's just, hey, you're not allowed to have this stuff on your website anymore. And you could pay massive penalties for having it on your platform. 17 million was a number that I saw in terms of kind of the average fine for being found liable for this. But the big piece here is actually content that's harmful to children. So now you need to confirm the age of people using your platform if you're going to show them anything like self-harm, eating disorder, suicide, or in particular pornography, I thought was an interesting one. So this basically says if you're Pornhub and you're trying to operate in the UK, you need to have age verification on your website. So I'm not necessarily interested in chatting about the Online Safety Act, although I think that it's an interesting piece of regulation, and I'm curious if the rest of the Eurozone will implement it. So the UK already has GDPR. Actually, all of the Eurozone has GDPR, which is rules about tracking data, tracking information. So if you have a website that collects information and you have users that are based out of the EU or the Euro Economic Zone, you need to disclose that and ask them if it's okay if you collect their information. This is a new level. The next iteration of that is the Online Safety Act. I'm curious where this goes, if everybody will adopt it. We've seen a pretty big push against pornography in most regions of the world. The US, I think South Korea might have had a push against porn recently. And then obviously the UK and EU are also pushing pretty heavily against protecting or for protecting children from pornography. The interesting component here to me is whether or not anonymity online is important, good or bad. I work in the crypto industry. I work in the blockchain industry. So people care a lot about anonymity. They care a lot about KYC as the antichrist. And it's ridiculous to expect people to out themselves. There's a lot of...
Can you explain what KYC is?
Yeah. Know your customer. So this is basically, if you want to open a bank account, you need to KYC. And that's providing some sort of proof that you are who you say you are. Typically, this will come in the form of an ID or a government issued ID or like an image of your face, something like that.
That's what VPC is for this. Verified parental consent is that when you go through an age gate, if you say you're under 13, you then have to hand it off, quote, to a parent. And the way you validate that is that they have a credit card. Yep. Which means you have to be at least 18. And that's the verified parental part, which introduces
ID by credit card, not state ID. Sounds like a sneaky way to get payment info.
No, I don't think it saves as a credit card. Oh, that's very smart though, Eric. I'd get credit card info. Okay.
What are you going to do with it? Genius. Fucking illegal to do anything with it.
Is it? You do authorize a payment.
You just save it so that it's like one penny fast checkout next time. Like,
well, but yeah, that's different. So nice, that's different than age verification with a credit card. Hey, are you 18 or older? Please send us a credit card so that we know that a bank approved that you're 18 years or older.
But Eric's saying you can then save that as saved information and make it for in-app purchases.
But a lot of the companies that do this, for example, forget the company. I'm blanking on the name, but they do KYC. They don't store that information. Like, they're not storing your credit card number. They're confirming that provided proof. And if you provided proof, then they put you in their server as having been KYC'd. It's almost like a zero knowledge algorithm. But I think it's interesting because in the age of AI and like autonomous agents, they like what percentage of Twitter is real accounts versus bot accounts? I think it's an interesting debate. Like, anonymity is a powerful thing. But in real life, we don't have anonymity. If I show up to the grocery store and I make purchases, like, you can see my face. If I'm passing my neighbor in my neighborhood, you can see my face. I'm not going to flick my neighbor off if he cuts me off at a stop sign because he's my neighbor. Versus online, I have this air of anonymity.
Even I would say, in theory, you could go to your grocery store with a full-on ski mask, purchase a bag of cookies, and you're allowed
sketchy.
To do
like
that.
It's unacceptable. It's socially unacceptable to do that.
But you can still do it. Like, they're not going to stop you.
Yeah, no, yes, but
like, this forces you to take off your ski mask is the difference.
Yeah, but nobody wears ski masks in public who aren't super sketchy. So I guess I'm probably a pro. I would like it for everybody on the internet to be real human beings. Okay, that's too far. I would like it for me to know whether I'm interacting with a human being or not a human being. Better yet, I would like to know the quality, the characteristics of that person, especially in the age of autonomous agents.
Yeah,
don't really have a strong philosophical argument for that, but I do think that the better we can emulate real interactions in our real world, the better the online world will be.
I don't think Chris is wrong. I would say, though, that I still see people saying nasty shit on Facebook. And that's like where you're supposed to have personal identity.
Yeah, but now people regret it and they stop using it because they're afraid of some shit that they said is,
I think that Facebook is an interesting case because I think a lot of times it's like we've all gotten upset with somebody, we said something we regret. Facebook is like that, but instead of just saying it to your spouse or your kid or your mom, you say it to everybody. You say, I'm angry and I'm going to make this post. Yeah. And it's 15 minutes later, you're like, fuck, I shouldn't have said that.
Yeah. And if you don't
there's an interesting aspect in which games is one of the few digital online mediums in which your history is not really recorded in that sense, right? There's very little permanence of your social interaction that could expose you to something like that.
Well,
and you're usually always anonymous within the side of the context of the game too.
Yeah. And a shout out, a little, what's the word when you're... Man, when you're shouting out somebody, we use this term all the time.
Is it shout out?
Mama, you made it?
Not shout out. No, just God almighty. It's like my brain
shut down.
I don't
think that's it either.
No, there's a term for, hey, man, you got a podcast. Oh, tell us about your podcast.
Chill.
Jesus Christ. I haven't been spending enough time online. Dude, I haven't been spending enough time online is what it is. I pretty much cut out.
Crypto.
I basically cut out all use of Twitter and Blue Sky and all.
Where's your once a month Web3 gaming is inevitable tweet? Everyone on the Web3 food line's got to do that. They're going to get whipped.
I forgot that. I do it in a Substack article every once in a while. Anyway, I'm going to shill a friend's company recently started. Got some pre-seed funding. PlaySafe ID. They got a million pounds, $1.2 million. But that's pre-seed, right? That's, hey, build this thing, get a couple 10,000 users and prove that this is something people want. But basically the idea is if you have an ID, it means that you are a unique human being and you have a track record. Any offenses, just the offenses themselves and your ID, not necessarily who you are, what your picture looks like or what the offense was, get recorded. And then it spits out a little, this person's a good guy, this person's a bad guy. And so when you go to log in, people know if you're a pedophile or not. They know whether you've said harmful things in chat logs. I think it's a really, especially in the age of AI, I think it's a really interesting concept. I think it's important. I know it's going to get a lot of pushback, especially from the crypto industry. But at the very least, like if we just had flags online of this is a human, this is not a human.
Yeah, like I think digital identity, like y'all said, is a big problem to solve. So.
No, I mean, it also helps with monetization and ads. Like, hey, I don't want to pay. Sure, you might have a billion users, but if 90% of them are bots, I'm not paying for bot traffic. I want to pay for premium users who are like human beings.
I think the danger is when, you know, everything you described is things people universally would describe as bad, like pedophiles. But like when it starts getting used for not objectively bad stuff, like political target and stuff.
Well, see, look at what's right in front of us. So if you're watching the YouTube version, you have one of the explanators from the UK government about the law. And so what they're arguing is that by law, children must be given age-appropriate access to what they're calling priority content. And so they categorize priority content as a couple different things. But one of them I want to point out as content that encourages dangerous stunts and challenges.
It's like Jackass.
That is now what, right? That is what regulators are going to be deciding. And so, okay, think about Trackmania, right? You remember Trackmania on Steam where you create all these crazy Hot Wheels style tracks? What if a car race? What if it was a streetcar race?
What? No, they're obviously not. Yeah,
and I think that right now what you're seeing in the UK is very scary when it comes to free speech regulation. Remember, they passed laws that certain behavior posted online, if it makes someone feel uncomfortable, can very easily, what they, not only just a hate act, but that is now illegal in the UK and you can be arrested.
Okay. Now that's on the regulation side, but I mean, it is a bit scary.
This is saying that you can still have access to it. Like, you can still have dangerous stunts and challenges.
Yeah.
They're age-gating it.
What we need is categorization. And hey, I'm playing in the safe zone. Like, it's all good over here. I'm not going to be exposed to anything crazy.
They have YouTube kids, right?
Yeah, exactly. And if I go outside of that, I'm consenting to that. It's like, okay, I know that I'm going into the danger zone. So like that play safe idea I was talking about, there might be platforms that are like, we don't want to use that because it goes against our principles. Or, we think you guys are punishing for stupid reasons, whatever. Everybody knows, I'm going to go into this zone and I know there's no play safe ID. It's just like a regular, it's like the Wild West. You end up with like almost a dark web kind of version of the normal web, where it's like the protected web, the unprotected web, and then the dark web. Now, free speech obviously is a whole thing, but as long as private companies are the ones making those decisions, then other private companies can decide whether or not to, and when I say private, I just mean capitalistic businesses can decide whether or not they want to participate in that market. As long as the market decides, I'm perfectly okay with it.
I just had a little story about anonymity. So there's been like ICE raids and stuff down in SoCal. I'm in Orange County, so I'm not really at the heart of it, but there's two stories that really scared me. Some Asian kid went up to LA. He doxed a bunch of ICE officers. Like, he put up posters with their personal information. And then he came back. And this is like an hour drive away from his house. And he got caught because the cell tower data triangulated his location to his address. And they found him at his address and arrested him. There was this other kid, some Hispanic kid, who was throwing bricks at ICE cars and broke a bunch of windows. And he also was caught by a very similar method. They like triangulated his cell data, identified where his house was. And his dad was an undocumented immigrant. And that guy got deported. So it just made me like super paranoid about like positional tracking and all these devices and stuff. And then they put up a bunch of these like cameras on the house, on the street around in our neighborhood, like these like traffic cameras. And yeah, I don't know. It's scary. It turns out those traffic cameras were just like traffic surveying cameras and not actually like police cameras, but I feel like anonymity is important for free speech.
Yeah, no, that's fair.
So did Mr. John Stuart Mill, our favorite econ utilitarian.
Yeah, add him to the heroes or whatever.
Heroes of history. All right, GameCon's
that was not as interesting as I thought it was going to be.
Episode 41, right? 41. We get this one right.
Yeah.
41 in the can. We're back. We're going to be on a regular schedule. Finally, our eternal quest. Till next time.
We should teach this to our children. Economics is major. Everyone has to major in economics. Number one, for personal survival. Economics is major.